Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hordes of college students across the country moved in over the Labor Day weekend. Many parents breathing a sigh of relief. It is no mean feat getting into and paying for higher education today, especially among America's prestigious Ivy League colleges and universities. With notoriously low acceptance rates, aspiring students must have near-perfect grades, test scores, and an array of community service and extracurricular activities to catch the eye of admissions committees. The stakes are high, but so are the rewards. The highest quality education America can offer. Or is it? In his book, Excellent Sheep, former Yale professor William Derezowitz argues that elite universities are not producing independent, critical thinkers, but instead herds of like-minded graduates opting for predictable, profitable careers. And William Derezowitz, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you were an Ivy Leaguer, an insider, and describe serving on an admissions committee at Yale. I think that description might send chills through the hearts of applicants and their parents. What were they looking for?
They were looking for kids who could do everything, who had done everything and done it very well, and then a couple of things that they had done really, really well. I mean, I should say the first thing that the admissions officer would read out about a candidate was their extracurriculars. And if they only had six or seven, then we knew they probably weren't going to get in, because normally you'd have 10 or 11.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but the problem is these kids have gotten very good at sort of getting the A's or checking the boxes. And how deep any of that stuff goes is really not clear.
Well, your description of the competition and the resources poured into getting kids into these elite schools reads like an arms race almost that begins at birth. So what to your mind gets lost in this kind of cutthroat competition?
What gets lost, I think, are the ability of kids to figure out what they want to do, right? To self-motivate, to choose their own path, right? Because they're jumping through the hoops that the adults hold up for them, and they're really, really good at it. So they get used to taking direction from the outside. And one of the problems that creates is that when they get to the end of the hoops, junior year, senior year in college, they're often at a loss to figure out what to do next. And when they do figure out what to do next, it's invariably about accumulating more credentials, continuing to get gold stars, competing with their peers, judging themselves in relationship to their peers and external standards of success. And that's also why a lot of these kids have kind of a sense of inner aimlessness or emptiness.
Well, how do you think it got this way? Now, you identify the 1960s as a kind of pivot from the old aristocracy to the new meritocracy. Now, what was this shift?
As people may know, back in the day, these Ivy League schools in particular, and a lot of the elite liberal arts colleges, were kind of finishing schools for rich white Protestant boys, for the WASP aristocracy. It was sort of what you automatically did after prep school. And in many cases, you know, you just sort of were let in. There was really very little of an admissions process. Eventually, that became untenable. And some of the people, at least, who were running the system, the more courageous ones, realized that things needed to change. And there was you know, a fairly sudden and in some ways controversial shift to what we call meritocracy, where now everybody, at least in theory, has an equal chance. People are, at least in theory, being judged on objective measures like SAT scores and grades, not where you went to school and what your last name is and so forth. And that's great, and that enabled us to create, you know, a multicultural, gender-neutral elite, which we didn't have. You know, there used to be Jewish quotas. My dad didn't apply to Columbia because he knew there was a Jewish quota. So that was terrific, but what's happened in the 50 years since then is that the families who are best able to prepare their kids for the admissions process, which means families with money, families where parents themselves have a good education, have been able to take advantage of the system, in many ways game the system, to make sure that their kids are the ones who are first in line. Mm.
And those rankings do win out, those numbers. And what kind of messages does that send to students who sort of win the sweeps and get in?
I mean, you know, part of what changed when the system changed was that when kids got to college, instead of being told, you've got to prove to us that you belong here because we could have admitted a completely different class that was just as good. Now kids are told, you're the greatest kids ever. This is the greatest class ever. This is the lowest admit rate and therefore the greatest. And kids like that, kids who get to that point, have been hearing that message probably since first grade. What does that do? You know, I mean, it breeds an enormous level of entitlement, an enormous level of self-satisfaction. And I think we see this in the products of the system. I mean, if the system has existed for 50 years, it means that it's been giving us our leadership class for 50 or at least 30 or 40 years. And I think that's exactly what we see among our adult leaders, this enormous sense of self-satisfaction, entitlement, and a tremendous sort of disconnection from everyone else in society.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we get these narrow social circles and narrow job choices. Those that you point out are what? Finance, consulting, other sort of corporate
law
leadership.
Law and medicine. Finance, consulting, law and medicine are the four things. Really, I mean, people have told me again and again, you go to career services and those are the things they're equipped to tell you about. Finance and consulting in particular, those firms descend in force on elite college campuses. They recruit. They've got a lot of money. They're very persuasive. And they take off between a quarter at Yale and 60% of graduates at Princeton go into just finance or consulting, not even counting law. 60%. This is an enormous waste of human capital for society. And I think a lot of these kids are doing it because, well, you know what a lot of them say is, listen, I don't have a particular passion, so I might as well go do something that I know I'm going to be good at and that's going to pay me really well. Mm. And my feeling is, you know, if that's true, that's probably a good choice. But the problem is that we've created a system where these really smart, energetic, talented kids, and I think good-hearted kids for the most part, haven't been able to discover a sense of purpose or passion and also have no clue about how to go about doing it.
Well, your book is championing finding one's vocation or purpose or passion through a quality liberal arts education, often at second-tier schools or state schools. So, are students and graduates from those schools that much more likely to be asking themselves about what a good life is and how they want to live it?
Well, let me be clear. I mean, I advocate those different kinds of institutions for different reasons. I absolutely think that the liberal arts colleges, and not necessarily all of them, but as a rule of thumb, the liberal arts colleges are much more about getting students to ask the questions, giving them a real broad education, an education that leads to self-knowledge, and not just producing professional competence. That's partly the kinds of institutions they are, and it's partly the kinds of students they draw. They're often the kinds of students who are just as smart as the ones who get into Stanford or Harvard, but they are self-directed enough to have felt in high school like, you know what, I'm not going to try to get an A in everything because I don't care about calculus. I'm going to do the thing that really matters to me. So, I think as a rule of thumb, liberal arts colleges do it better. The state schools, obviously, many of them are under-resourced giant schools. However, more and more of them have, there's several dozen now, honors colleges or honors programs within state schools that give you, or that attempt at least to give, a liberal arts college experience with small classrooms, a sort of focused curriculum with dedicated teachers at the price of a public education.
Are America's elite institutions of higher ed churning out competent zombies heading meekly in the same direction towards jobs in finance and consulting and medicine and law? That's a question asked in a new book called Excellent Sheep. It's by my guest, Will Derisiewicz. Will, is success, though, in conventional terms, you know, such a terrible thing if somebody is making good money in finance or medicine or law and having a good life?
Yeah, look, I mean, everyone is going to find their own way to what's meaningful and purposeful. And I really make a point in the book of not judging one profession over another. The real issue is how you choose to do what you're doing. Did you choose to go into finance and consulting because you really feel like that's your mission in life? Or is it because you didn't really have anything better to do and you might as well make a lot of money?
You have really thrown down the glove or started a real conversation and been criticized for relying on anecdotes, for exaggerating the anxiety and depression among high school students about getting into elites, sour grapes at being denied tenure at Yale. I wonder, is there anything that you want to respond to here?
Okay. Yes, thank you. Look, first of all, about evidence and anecdotes, I quote a lot of statistical evidence in connections where statistical evidence can be brought to bear. For instance, on the mental health epidemic among affluent teenagers. People have written books about this. People have done studies about this. 50% of Yale students now go to the mental health service at some point during college. In some areas that I talk about, it's really not possible to quote statistics. I don't think you can, you know, quote a statistic about whether a student feels a sense of purposelessness or how seriously they're taking their classes in an intellectual sense. But I not only taught at Yale for 10 years and spent a total of 24 years in the Ivy League, I started writing about this 6 years ago in an essay that went viral very much to my surprise and has now been viewed over 1 million times. I've gotten hundreds of emails as a result. I've gotten hundreds more emails since this book started to come out. And I've also heard from professors and teachers, and I've read a lot about it. And I don't have systematic evidence, but I have a lot of very substantial evidence about this, that the things I'm talking about are real things. And I think the closer you get to these kids as a teacher, as a counselor, the more you see it.
I have plenty of friends who are going through this, you know, getting their kids into the right schools. And it's very difficult not to get swept up into the rat race. So how do we find our way out of this trap?
Yeah, that's, I think, the hardest question you can ask. And I think there are a few things to say. I mean, I have tried to outline alternatives. It might comfort parents to know that there's a very well-researched study that says that for most kids, where you go to college actually doesn't affect how much you end up making in your career, because it's much more about who you are than where you go to school. But there's no question that there are advantages to going to the most prestigious schools. And you're going to have to surrender those advantages to make a different choice. I mean, the advantage really is about status. It's really about connections. It's about sort of getting ushered into the elite. What I want people to understand is that it doesn't come without a cost. If you make a choice to drop out of that, you are depriving your kids of certain things. If you make a choice to play the game, you are also depriving your kids of certain things. And in my view, more important things, the ability to ultimately live a happy life by being able to judge yourself based on your own standards of success, the ability to do something in your life that may be the thing that you most care about and that you're best at. I mean, there's so many, you know, in theory, these kids can do whatever they want. In practice, they tend to do one of four or five or a few other things. And all the other possibilities in life are closed to them only for psychological reasons, because they're not prestigious enough.
A lot of really provocative questions and no easy answers. And Will DeRozowitz, I want to thank you for speaking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Will DeRozowitz received his own elite education at Columbia. He also taught there and at Yale. His essay, The Disadvantages of an Elite Education, went hyperviral and has been extended into the new book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. You'll find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we're going to hear the story of two young women who knew exactly what they wanted to study when they went to college. Their passion for science took them all the way to the Galapagos Islands. That story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a young man, Charles Darwin visited the Galapagos Islands and cemented his passion for science and nature through careful observation of birds and other wildlife. Now, more than 150 years later, a pair of women scientists has traveled to those same islands to follow their passion for studying the natural world. Producer Veronique Le Capra brings us the story.
I'm Veronique, and this is Mari.
Mi nombre es Mari Cruz Jaramillo, y soy de Quito, Ecuador.
Mari Cruz Jaramillo grew up in Ecuador's capital, Quito, but she always loved being out in nature.
When I look at pictures of myself when I was little, I always see, like, I have a really happy face when I'm outside. I don't know, maybe I associated it with spending time with my family, my dad. Then I could just run and I would pick up stuff from the ground. And I just really love being outdoors.
I was pretty much the same way. I brought my mom home tadpoles, caterpillars, earthworms, and eventually a PhD in Ecology and Evolution. Mari's getting hers now from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And she's doing fieldwork in the one place I think every ecologist wants to go.
Ever since I knew I wanted to be a biologist, I wanted to come to the Galapagos Islands. That was my goal. And my dream, too.
But they're not easy to get to. The Galapagos Islands are in the Pacific, 600 miles west of Ecuador. From St. Louis, it took me 2 days, 3 flights, a ferry ride, and 45 minutes in a pickup truck to get there. Charles Darwin took a ship, the HMS Beagle. He was only 26 when he visited the Galapagos, about Mari's age. What he saw changed his life and the history of science. Most of the wildlife that lives on these volcanic mounds is found nowhere else in the world. Giant tortoises, marine iguanas, and those little sparrow-like birds known as Darwin's finches. Mari first made it to the Galapagos 5 years ago. She's back again, studying a kind of malaria that's infecting birds here. In Hawaii, avian malaria has driven many native bird species to extinction. That hasn't happened in the Galapagos, but Mari and other scientists are trying to gauge the threat.
It's 5:30 in the morning, and it's just barely starting to get light in the sky. I'm meeting the researchers who are going to be setting up some mist nets to catch birds.
Who wants to set another net?
Mist nets look sort of like volleyball nets, but around twice as high and reaching almost to the ground. Their mesh is nearly invisible. The birds fly right into it and get snagged. Mari and the others work quickly to untangle them.
When you have a bird in your hand, it's just really warm and soft, and you can feel its really fast heartbeat. And you just know that you're holding something really fragile.
Each bird gets weighed and measured.
This one's 45 grams.
Mari, or one of her helpers, takes a small blood sample to test later for malaria. Then they release the bird again.
This little one is ready to go.
Samoa Asigao speaks Motu, along with Pidgin and English, among the many languages in her country, Papua New Guinea. It's an island nation just north of Australia. Samoa met Mari in graduate school in St. Louis. She's in the Galapagos, trying to help solve a different piece of the avian malaria puzzle. Which species of mosquito is transmitting the parasite from bird to bird? Just before dusk, Samoa sets out her traps.
The thing about trapping mosquitoes is you have to think like a mosquito.
Female mosquitoes, they're the ones that bite and can spread disease, like to lay their eggs in stagnant water. So Samoa mixes up a smelly brew for her traps.
Every time I pour this water, in my mind I'm like thinking like, mosquitoes, please come, come to it. So I can trap more mosquitoes in the morning. Seriously, that's what I do every time. Oh, it smells good, right?
Actually, it smells like rancid gym socks. The smellier the water, the more mosquitoes she'll get and be able to dissect. Working with a microscope, delicate tools, and very steady hands, she'll chop off their tiny heads and extract their salivary glands to look for the malaria parasite. Samoa has stared at so many mosquitoes so close up, she has started to appreciate them, especially a species called Aedes aegypti.
It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's covered in these black and white bands all over its legs, all over its abdomen, its face, and yeah, the first time I saw it under a microscope, I kind of fell in love with it in a weird way.
Samoa says her parents encouraged her to get an education and pursue a career in science, but she says most people in Papua New Guinea hold strongly to traditional beliefs and gender roles.
And just growing up and looking around and seeing the opportunities that were given to males rather than females, that sort of placed an aggression in me, good aggression. It told me that, hey, why do males always have to get chosen over females?
For Samoa, becoming a scientist started out as a way to prove herself. But eventually, it became more than that.
I realized that, no, science was something that I really wanted to do.
Once she gets her PhD, Samoa wants to return to Papua New Guinea to help protect wildlife there. and she hopes to be a role model and train a new generation of female scientists.
Empower young girls, empower women, and tell them, you know, if I can come from a country like Papua New Guinea, come and do research in a place like Galapagos and study at an institution like my university, then you can do it too.
Her friend Mari plans to keep doing research in her home country of Ecuador, maybe in the Galapagos Islands.
I don't know exactly if I would enjoy my life as much if I wasn't a scientist.
Sometimes, though, Mari thinks about all the hard work and long hours.
But then I realized, like, what else would I be doing? I wouldn't be enjoying it as much if I was doing something else. So it's my way of life. It's essentially what I am, I think.
I'm Veronique LaCapra.
And that story was produced for the PRX STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, you've tackled your summer reading list, maybe plowed through a few entertaining beach reads or lost track of time with a particularly good novel over the Labor Day weekend. But now it is September, time to get serious about your to-be-read list. Thankfully, fall is the biggest season in the publishing world, and we have with us a tried-and-true book curator, Michelle Philgate. She's a freelance writer and a critic and an independent bookseller at Community Bookstore in Brooklyn. Her writing has appeared in The Rumpus, The Daily Beast, and Salon, just to name a few. It's great to have you back with us, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
So some of us read for plot, some go for the beauty of the sentence, and some just want a character to dig into and fall in love with. Are there any books on your fall list that tackle all three?
Yes, Florence Gordon by Brian Morton features one of the most memorable characters I've come across in recent years, but it also has incredible prose and a really great plot, too. I think that Brian does something that not a lot of writers do very well. He is amazing at writing about senior citizens. Hmm. One of his previous novels is one of my favorite books called Starting Out in the Evening that was turned into a movie with Frank Langella about an older writer who befriends a younger writer who idolizes him. And in this book, he returns to writing about a writer who, in this case, is the title of the book is her name, Florence Gordon. And she's a feminist writer who's 75 years old and lives in New York City. She's very set in her ways and hasn't quite got the attention that she deserves as a writer. And her family moves back to New York City, and she has to kind of grapple with, you know, her routine being shuffled around. So it's very much about living the artistic life. It's very much about a stubborn but admirable woman. And it's a character that I just think will stay with me for a long time.
And that's Florence Gordon by Brian Morton. And we will have Michelle's complete list of books that she's looking forward to for September at wordofmouthradio.org. So what else do I see here on your list? Merritt Tierce. Who's that and what's the
yes.
book?
She's a debut writer, and this book really shocked me in that I wasn't expecting to like it, given the subject matter, and it really just blew me away. It's called Love Me Back. And it's about a waitress who's a mother and who's very sexually promiscuous and struggling with being a mother and struggling with being a woman and working in a restaurant. It's very much like an insider view of what it's like to work in that world. The writing itself is so brazenly honest and raw and just... It resonated with me. And everyone I know who's read it has kind of felt the same way about this book. I think that a lot of people will be talking about it.
So sounds like a tough life, single mother, struggling with having kids. But, you know, sometimes we just need one of these books to remind us of how good we do have it in this world. Anything that fits that bill?
Yes. So Emily St. John Mandel, I've been a fan of hers since her first book. This is actually her fourth novel. Knopf, which is one of the best publishers, picked her up for this book called Station 11. And it's set in a post-apocalyptic world. So what we're seeing here is it's kind of following the trend of some other recent literary books like The Dog Stars by Peter Heller, which, in fact, it's edited by the same editor, and Zone One by Colson Whitehead, which was a zombie literary novel. Mm-hmm. In Emily's book, it follows basically a flu has wiped out most of civilization. And this book really focuses on what matters and what stays with us. There's a traveling Shakespearean company and a symphony, and it proves that art resonates no matter what. And it's a hopeful book at the same time as being set in this world where everything has changed.
So that is Station 11, Emily St. John Mandel.
Yes.
Now, that's about a flu wiping out a big portion of the population. And I know there's a lot of concern and fear about epidemics now. Any good books that pick up on these anxieties?
Yes, absolutely. Eula Biss's On Immunity, which is one of the best nonfiction books I've read in recent years. And Eula is a very talented writer in that she made me interested in a topic I didn't think I would be interested in at all. You know, she's talking about how immunization is important, vaccinations are important, and she is writing about this from the perspective of a mother. I am not a mother. I'm not interested in having kids, but reading this book really transcends the subject and proves that this is a topic that is important for every responsible citizen. She blends her own experience with literary criticism and history and science and medicine. And so it's one of those books that really makes you want to learn more about the subject.
Does she wade into this whole non-vaccine autism thing, or is it something else?
She comes down on the side of immunization is important.
We're talking about some hotly anticipated books in September with Michelle Filgate. She often introduces us to some off-the-beaten-path books as well as some of the most anticipated books in the publishing world. How about, Michelle, a good novel of those who want something other than a nonfiction book, a little bit of mystery, maybe a little bit of romance?
Yeah, one of my favorite reads this year, it's coming out next month, it's called The Paying Guests, and it's by the British novelist Sarah Waters, who has already written several novels. And she's really good at the atmospheric, romantic mystery novel, which is what this is. This is kind of the smart beach read. I almost wish it had come out over the summer, but it's also a great book to read in front of the fireplace on a cold winter or autumn day. What it is it's set after World War I has ended, and a mother and daughter need to let strangers move in with them so they can afford their bills. And this young couple moves into the house, and a lesbian romance ensues. And it feels gothic and dark, kind of like Rebecca and Jane Eyre. So it's a really great page-turner.
There's also a book from a small press that's getting a lot of attention. Tell us about this one. A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. And this is by, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this right, Emma McBride.
Yes, Coffeehouse Press was really excited to get their hands on this book, and it ended up winning the Bailey's Fiction Prize, which is a prize for women writers who write in English. It's a big deal to get that. This is the Irish author's debut novel, I believe, and it centers around a girl who is really trying to find herself and failing over and over again. It's really tough book to read, but it's an incredibly rewarding book to read. Her brother has a terminal illness. He has a brain tumor. And the book touches on deals with rape and incest and sexuality and the relationship between siblings. And what's really a standout about this book is the way it's written, because she does a whole new thing. The sentences are written in fragmented thoughts, kind of how our thoughts are formed in our heads before we're really articulating them. So they're very incomplete sentences, but there's a poetry in that. And once you get into the rhythm of the book, it's unlike anything you've ever read before. So it's really innovative.
So you've gone through some September books. Any other big books that you're excited about coming out this fall?
Yes. So Marilyn Robinson, the Pulitzer Prize winning author who wrote Housekeeping, she has a third book coming out in the Gilead series. So there was Gilead and Home and now Lila, which is about the wife of the minister in Gilead. And you don't have to have read that book or any of her books to read this one. It also stands alone. But her writing, she is the master of the lyrical sentence.
And when's that coming out?
That's coming out in October. And then we also have David Mitchell's Bone Clocks. Now, David Mitchell, most people know, wrote Cloud Atlas. He's just, again, another incredible writer, and it's very exciting. It's going to get a lot of attention.
Michelle, obviously, you work at a bookstore. You're very tapped into what's going on in the publishing world. But where do you go to find out what's coming up for books?
So besides your local independent bookstore, which is way better than an Amazon algorithm, you can go. The Millions is one of my favorite literary websites, and they do this great list every year called the most anticipated books. And they also just released one recently for the second half of the year, where they list by month the books that are coming out and write a little thing about each book. So that's a great resource. I also recommend FlavorWire. They just put out a list of anticipated books for the fall. And Publishers Weekly also has a books to look forward to. So those are all great resources.
Michelle Philgate, freelance writer, critic, and independent bookseller at Community Bookstore in Brooklyn. Thank you for sharing your insider's knowledge with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we do have links to Michelle's site and more on the books that came up today. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Professors and editors repeat that line that most people already know. Wikipedia is not a credible source. While Wikipedia editors do their best to check the facts, the sheer volume of submissions and information is insurmountable. And when a fact appears on Wikipedia, it has a way of slithering into the cultural conversation and consciousness. One reporter fessed up to falsifying information on Wikipedia about a semi-obscure children's author after realizing what an impact the prank could have. E.J. Dixon wrote the article, "I Accidentally Started a Wikipedia Hoax for Daily Dot," and joins us now to explain. E.J., welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
All right, so what fact did you make up?
So I believe the fact that I made up was that Amelia Bedelia was inspired by the author Peggy Parrish's experiences as a maid in French colonial Cameroon. Is that right?
You don't even have the fact straight on the fact that you made up?
Yeah, I don't have it out in front of me, but I think it was something like that. So I can't, say it verbatim.
Why Amelia Bedelia?
I think we were just looking for, semi-obscure children's authors whose pages we could screw with. I think that was our only motivation.
So she's actually known as a character for taking things far too literally for comic results. Now, this sort of hoax seems a little meta. I assume that was not your intent.
No, we didn't really have an intent, to be perfectly honest. I mean, as I write in the piece, we were quite intoxicated, inebriated at the time. So that was pretty much our only motivation.
Where did the fact go from there?
So what happened was, I didn't think of it much until 5.5 years later when I see someone tweeted it, a screen grab of the very fact that I wrote on my Twitter feed. And I just freaked out. I couldn't believe that it had been up on Wikipedia and not edited for 5.5 years. Because you hear that, Wikipedia editors are so judicious about correcting their facts and that barely any edits really lasts long on the page. I just couldn't believe that this particular one had endured for so long.
Well, this had been cited all over the place in a lesson plan by a Taiwanese English professor, in a book about Jews and Jesus. Just took off, this little story that you made up in an inebriated state. Now, you did speak with a Wikipedia editor to figure out how something like this could go undetected for years. Now, what was his explanation?
His explanation was basically that there's sort of a hierarchy of Wikipedia lies, basically, is what they are. So if you write something about One Direction, that Harry Styles is gay. I don't know why that's the example that I just came up with, but it is. that'll be taken down almost immediately because it's just so, you don't have any factual basis for it. It's just so outrageous that, you can't keep it up. It'll just be taken down immediately. Whereas a more subtle lie, like the Cameroon factoid, is one that can pretty much go undetected for years because no one's really going to, nobody really cares enough about Amelia Bedelia to judiciously edit the page, and B, it sounds like it could be true.
Poor Amelia Bedelia. Well, okay, so obviously when there is an interest, we remember the Sarah Palin in 2011 describing the ride of Paul Revere with some historical inaccuracies, and supporters rose to her defense, changed the Wikipedia page on Paul Revere's ride to reflect her version of events. So a lot of internet hoaxes can have a lot of, I don't know, sinister results. A death notice might be circulated for someone still very much alive. Impossible challenges to go viral. In the big picture, what effect do you think your faked fact has had?
I honestly do not know. I've been asked if I've heard from the Parrish family. I have not. I reached out to them when I was writing the article. I don't know what they would think. I assume they would just think that me and my friends who wrote the page with me were just like idiot teenagers, and would just be confused and befuddled by the whole thing, to be perfectly honest.
Well, what it seems to say is that our concept of little known history could be riddled with errors, and we'll probably never really get to know it. Is this just an outcome of living in the digital age?
I think so. I mean, the publication that I write for, The Daily Dot, covers internet news. So, I mean, this is something that I sort of deal with on a day-to-day basis. Like, in the news cycle, something will go viral, something will come out, and then a few hours later, it'll be immediately debunked. It's never been easier to disseminate a lie, and it's never been easier to convince people that the lie is true.
EJ Dixon, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to your cat, too.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear it?
Just once or twice.
Oh, she's super needy today. I apologize.
EJ Dixon, staff reporter at The Daily Dot. She wrote the article, "I Accidentally Started a Wikipedia Hoax," about her experience of being at the epicenter of a pretty harmless internet rumor. You'll find a link to read her article at wordofmouthradio.org. Among adolescent memories, the first concert is right up there with first crush and prom. Up next, we're going to stay outside the venue to hear what parents do with themselves after they've dropped the kids off at the venue. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As kids head back to school, it's time to get nostalgic for those adolescent days and some of the milestones that come along with it. Those collective experiences that stick in your brain long after graduation. The first kiss, your first driver's license, prom. Kevin Flynn brings us the story of an adolescent milestone that parents are often dragged into, whether they like it or not.
I have to keep in mind, I've done this to myself. It's because of me that I'm sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic on Route 128 with two 14-year-old girls playing an endless game of Would You Rather.
Or would you rather your husband decide to sign you guys up for couples parachute and pull you down out of a parachute?
I'm heading to Foxborough's Gillette Stadium to bring my daughter to her first real concert. I mean, this is a monumental moment for her. I remember when my parents took me to see Billy Joel when I was 14 years old. Only the soundtrack has changed.
So, guys, where are we going tonight?
The One Direction concert.
You don't know you're beautiful. If only you saw what I can see.
What are you expecting?
A lot of screaming.
From you or from other people?
From me.
Are you going to scream?
Yes.
And what's everybody around you going to be doing?
Screaming.
Yeah, that sounds like a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
Finally, we arrive. The crowd streaming into the stadium seem young, like maybe still hold your hand crossing the street young. Lily and Elizabeth join them, and I am left alone. But not really. So many parents have ditched their kids at the turnstile that the venue has designated one of the parking lots as the parent drop-off point. So the big question is, what does an army of adults, who'd rather not be listening to teeny bopper music, do for the next 3 hours?
Tailgating. Waiting for the concert to be over.
Mark and Michelle Perret have dropped their daughter and a friend off and are now tailgating. Literally sitting on a tailgate at a One Direction concert.
Mm-hmm. Tailgating,
my
yes.
My truck, my F-150, and we're tailgating.
Just a couple beers, and then a couple beers at the bar.
We got some beers here. We're going to go down there and get some food. in one of thy restaurants.
And that's
I don't know how many...
rest of the parents are hiding.
I'm sure there's going to be a load of parents over there.
What other concerts have you been to where you've tailgated?
Oh, jeez. Ozzy, Kid Rock, we had Slayer.
What do you remember about those tailgates?
There weren't any kids.
By the time the opening act hits the stage, Mark and Michelle have already fled to the restaurant hideout. And the parking lot is devoid of people. No grills, no beers, just Larry and Colleen St. Ange. Now, are you a One Direction fan?
Yes.
Really? Who's your favorite?
I don't know.
Can you name any of them?
Harry.
Harry.
Can you name one of them without your husband's help?
No.
No. And then the lights go out. One Direction has taken the stage. A shriek of 130 decibels and 10,000 kilohertz swells from inside. At the security gate, peering into the stadium, are some moms and dads. Among them, Wayne Chase, who traveled over 5 hours all the way from Syracuse, New York, to bring his daughters to the concert. He chose to spend some quality time alone.
I was the driver, and I ended up hanging outside here and having dinner and going to a movie all by myself.
So essentially what you're saying to your daughters is, I love you enough to get you these tickets, but I don't love you enough to watch this concert.
But yes, I love them enough to let them experience it without me and then share it with me later.
Right. And that's the thing that gets me as I walk around and observe parents patiently waiting in cars, milling aimlessly about. They don't like this stuff at all, but it's the kind of thing you do for your kid. Hey, how was it?
It was good.
Just good? Just good?
No.
It was wonderful.
It was fantastic.
Would I have liked it?
No.
I would not have liked it.
No, unless you were like the dad behind us who was taking selfies with his daughter during the show.
Oh, that's so sweet. Do you want to take a selfie with me?
No, thank you.
Look, if it came down to it, of course I would take that seat next to my daughter. And maybe a teeny part of me thinks I'm missing out on something special with her. But then, driving back, I have to keep in mind, I've done this to myself.
Or would you rather marry an actor and just be getting by week to week?
Barely. For Word of Mouth, I'm Kevin Flynn. The story of my life, I'll take
her home. Here's a little postscript to that story. One Direction is nearing the end of its Where We Are World Tour, which has already grossed more than $230 million in ticket sales, making it the highest grossing tour of this year. And that includes Beyonce and Jay-Z, by the way, and one of the highest grossing tours of all time. And they still have 15 dates to go. Statistics aside, that story got us thinking about our first concert experiences. For me, it was punk's High Priestess Patti Smith at the Orpheum in Boston. I was all of 14, and no, my parents were not involved. Here's what some of the other folks around NHPR had to say.
What was your first concert?
Huey Lewis and the News. It was the Sports Tour.
NKOTB, also known as New Kids on the Block, for their Hangin' Tough Tour.
August 1988, Madison Square Garden, in excess. And they opened with What You Need, in case you wanted to know.
Amber is the color of her energy. Do you remember that? That's 311. Okay. Okay, so that they were definitely there.
Dave Matthews Band was my first concert. Yeah. My second concert was more interesting. It was Billy Joel.
Yeah, it was the Beastie Boys.
Grand Funk Railroad.
Nice.
Yeah.
What was your very first concert? Do you remember?
Maybe Led Zeppelin.
Maybe Led, like you don't remember if you saw Led Zeppelin first?
Weird Al Yankovic, Drury Lane, Oak Brook, Illinois. This is before he was the number one artist in the country, so I was into Weird Al before being into Weird Al was cool. What is-
Can't figure any lyrics out. And we'd love to hear from you. What was your first concert? You can tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter at wordofmouth. After all, some of the best true confessions are passed around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.